The Commentary Track. Conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello. Welcome to episode 65 of The Commentary Track. Today's guest is a great one, one of my favorite people in the world, Lloyd Kaufman, one of the heads of Troma Pictures, and one of the greatest guys in the world, says I. We'll get to that in a minute. First, I want to, as I do every week, urge you to support the podcast either monetarily or non-monetarily. To do it monetarily, you just go to the website, thecommentarytrack.com. Be sure and put the in front of it, because there's another one that just has... I hesitate to even use the horrible word reviews at commentarytrack.com. Mine is thecommentarytrack.com. Go there and you'll see a donate button. It'll take you to PayPal and Bob's your uncle. You can also support the podcast in a non-financial way, and I encourage that as well. You can spread the word on Facebook, on Twitter, on... I don't know, maybe you have a MySpace account still. If you do, God bless you, and mention it there, too. Wherever the social media flit around the world, mention the Commentary Track and try to get other people to come listen, and I will dance at your wedding. You can go to iTunes, and I urge you to do this, and leave a nice review, 5-star rating, and try to do both if you can, but, you know, if you can only carve out enough time in your day to click the 5-star button, then do that. But if you can write a few words about how much you like the podcast, I wish you would do that too. That would really help me out. Need to build some more listeners. I'm not going to build any more listeners. I don't even know how to build one listener. If I did, I'd have already built an army of them. I want to build my listenership. That's the ship that my listeners come in on, and I want to build that. So please, help me out. Spread the word. I get a lot of really, really, really nice comments about the podcast, and that warms the cockles of my heart, whatever that is, and I would be most pleased if I thought that people were saying the same nice things about the podcast to other people, encouraging them to listen up. And I really think anybody would want to listen to today's, because Lloyd Kaufman is one of the most interesting guys ever. He's funny. He's incredibly smart. He speaks Chinese. Come on, I should have gotten him to do that on the podcast just for our Chinese listeners, and I'm sure we have a lot. We recorded this outside. He was in Santa Monica. They were doing a marathon of Troma films at the Aero Theater, the American Cinematheque, in Santa Monica that night. This has been a couple of weeks ago, I guess. And so he was staying at what is not the nicest hotel in Santa Monica by any means, and he was quite proud of that fact. And the extent of how not nice it was is that he didn't even want me to come into the room. So we set up outside at a table just outside the main office of the hotel. And I was worried about the sound. Whenever you're outside, especially just a block from the beach with a road right next to where you're sitting, you're always worried there's going to be traffic noise and wind and people just walking by and everything. And actually, it turns out okay. The sound is fine. Believe me, I've been in some situations where the sound could not be fixed, and you know what I'm talking about if you're a long-time listener. But this one turned out fine. But there is one little oddity, and that is that his wife came walking up right in the middle of it, and we just started chatting. Her name is Patricia Swinney Kaufman, and she was the executive director of the New York State Governor's Office for Motion Picture and Television Development and the deputy commissioner of Empire State Development. She's also worked with Lloyd on some of his films as a producer and is just a great person. And I was delighted to finally meet her after hearing Lloyd rave about her for so many years. But I didn't really know what to do about this part of the recording, because she walked up behind us not wanting to intrude. And then Lloyd mentioned that she was there. And to face her, I had to turn around in my seat. So we chatted for a few seconds, not more than a minute or so, because it turns out she was born in North Carolina and I was born in South Carolina, and we both found that fascinating when we talked about that for a minute. And so you won't be able to hear that very well, but it sort of segues back into the conversation in such a way is that I couldn't really figure out a way to trim it without it just sounding like something had been clipped out. And I find that when there's an abrupt clip in something I'm listening to, I start obsessing on what they took out. I start thinking, wow, that must have been something really great or something really dirty or something that the man doesn't want me to hear. But you'll hear that this is just aimless chit-chat for a few seconds, and then we get right back to it. And so the to be forewarned is to be forearmed. So take all of your forearms and embrace the great Lloyd Kaufman, and I'll see you on the other side. I read something just the other day when I was seeing if there was something about you that I didn't know, which I find unlikely.
Pretty out there.
Yeah, it's pretty out there. But it mentioned that you had made a film real early on that was an homage to Harold Lloyd and Buster Keaton, and it didn't give the title of it. And I'd never heard you mention any such thing.
It's a lost film.
Oh, no.
It's been lost. It was called Roland's Return, but I don't know. Honestly, I think I lost it. It was about a 40-minute film.
And it was like a silent comedy?
Yes, or it was silent. Wow. Totally silent. Didn't even have music.
and
it was black and white and shot with a Bolex, the usual.
Yeah, and I read that you showed it to Lloyd, or that Lloyd saw it.
No. The Girl Who Returned was another film that I made. And that was the one where I did some John Cage silent. I had some pieces of black in between scenes to replicate John Cage's silence.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And it was a big mistake because every time the black came around, people would look behind them thinking the projector was broken.
Sure.
But the Return to Newcombe High, Girl Who Returned, the Girl Who Returned, I sent to Fritz Lang. Somehow I met him and I got his,
wow.
He gave me his home address in Bel Air. I sent him the 16mm print. And the film is unwatchable. And the poor guy was at the, he only had one eye left. And I guess I made him watch it. And he sent me a one-line letter back, Dear Mr. Kaufman. I was still at Yale at the time.
Yeah.
Dear Mr. Kaufman, I watched your film. That was it. And I was so proud of that. I really cherished that.
Sure.
It was fabulous.
You got a letter from Fritz Lang.
I know. It was pretty amazing.
That's,
yeah, that was the Girl Who Returned. It wasn't.
Yeah.
I don't believe I had any. I don't remember having any interface with Harold Lloyd.
No.
He does have a good last name, though.
He sure does.
I like that.
Now, speaking of Lloyd and Keaton,
yes,
and those guys, I know you started out being a theater guy, but were you always a movie buff at the same time? I mean, did you grow up loving movies?
I did not grow up loving movies. My mother was a theater person. We had a lot of famous theater people at our house. And a lot of drunken famous theater people at our house.
The best kind.
And so I grew up in that New York atmosphere, cafe society, I guess you could call it. I loved the Broadway musicals. I loved theater. I went to see every musical that I could. Bye Bye Birdie was Lucille Ball in Tenderloin, I think it was called. I saw every flop, they all had a good Sail Away with Elaine Stritch. They all had they all had at least one showstopper. There was always something to see, even if they weren't successful.
Sure.
Subways Are for Sleeping, which followed West Side Story for Carol Lawrence. It was her next film with Sidney Chaplin. It was great, but a lot of them weren't successful, but they always had a good one good showstopper song. But I had no interest in going into that as a profession. I was going to be, it was the 60s, so I was going to be a social worker or a teacher. I was very much inspired by my high school teachers, and I came, and my mother also said, you know, it's not all about money. Teaching, you could be a teacher and have just as joyful a life as even though she was out to 5 in the morning. I would go to school, and she'd be coming back home from her theater people.
Wow.
And But I was going to be a teacher or a social worker and do good things, change the world, make the world a better place, teach people with hooks for hands how to finger paint, and teach bums how to write, how to make paint beads with happy faces and string the beads together, sure. All that kind of stuff. But Yale University put me in a room with a movie nut. The guy who ran the Yale Film Society was my roommate. And so I would drift into the Film Society at Yale, and I started getting blown away. John Ford, Howard Hawks, Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton, Stan Brakhage, arguably the greatest visual artist of my lifetime, Andy Warhol. I mean, I hadn't seen it. I didn't even know there was such a thing as a movie director. Honestly, I went to Yale University. I didn't. Before I went in, I never was conscious of, you know, I knew who Preminger was, of course, but I didn't really think of him as a director. It was more like an impresario.
Sure.
Hitchcock was a character. I had no concept of the art of the directing. And I speak French, so I happened to find the, at the Yale Film Society offices, they had the, nobody read them because they didn't speak French, the Cahiers du Cinéma, which is the magazine of the French Cinémathèque.
Sure.
And in those days, it was written by Godard and Chabrol and Melville and those guys, who were critics slash journalists and later filmmakers, and they propounded the auteur theory of filmmaking, in which the filmmaker is the author of the movie, and in total, the director should be the total controlling spirit of the movie.
Yeah.
So I bought into the auteur theory of cinema and started looking for movies of people like Samuel Fuller and Joseph H. Lewis and Ulmer and Borzaghi and Murnau, and I went film crazy. I went totally off the deep end. And I'm still a film nut, but I did not know much about film, nor was I terribly interested through my first 18 years of life.
Yeah, that's interesting, because you and I have known each other such as we know each other.
A long time, yeah.
For, I'd say, 15 years
at least,
or so.
Yeah, at least.
And it's always struck me that it would probably surprise many of the trauma fanatics how much you love cinema. I mean, real... what you'd call, you know, art,
yeah,
cinema.
Well, they don't, yeah. A lot of them don't know that there were movies before Star Wars. They yeah. honestly don't know. I'll never forget when we were in the video days, the guy who bought the movies for Blockbuster, he honestly believed film history started with Star Wars. That's where it started. I mean, this is the guy who was buying for Blockbuster. And needless to say, Troma never had a movie in Blockbuster. We never had a movie in 40 years, not even Cannibal the Musical by Trey Parker and Matt Stone or yeah. The Toxic Avenger or none of those movies. We'd never had anything in Blockbuster.
Well, that should be a mark of pride to some extent.
At this point, it is. We outlasted them.
Yeah. You're still here.
We are still here. Troma is still here. And we're still making movies.
Now, I was going over your filmography the other day, and I saw a connection to Wellman that I never realized that you had, because, you know, Wellman is a big deal for me. And on your film The Newcomers, you wrote the script with the pen name Vicki Lester.
Well,
which is from A Star Is Born, right?
I don't know any, what you're talking about. That's Louis Sue directed that movie. It's as good as it is. I cannot take credit for that.
Well,
however, I did interview Louis Sue in my book, Produce Your Own Damn Movie.
Yeah.
And I learned quite a bit from him. Apparently, he felt that movies like The Newcomers and Divine Obsession were a good way to go to film school. Instead of going to film school, you know, you could learn a lot from those kind of movies. And I wondered how Louis Sue had gotten his style and wit. But at any rate, Wellman certainly was one of the greats of all time, and won the first Academy Award winner, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Have you seen The Restored Wings?
I have indeed, yes.
Yeah.
And here is the New York State Film Commissioner, retired, just casually walking along. Pat Swinney Kaufman, 40 years, the first co-lady of Troma, and my wife. And she is the executive producer of Poultrygeist, Night of the Chicken Dead. And we used her retirement money.
Did you marry her when she was four?
She's from North Carolina, by the way.
I'm from South Carolina.
No way.
I am.
Which town?
I was born in Aiken and then grew up near Spartanburg.
Oh, my gosh. Which town near Spartanburg?
A little town called Jonesville between Spartanburg and Union.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. And I grew up in Charlotte.
I know Charlotte very, very well.
And went to the beach at Litchfield, which is South Litchfield, which is now actually technically considered part of Pollard Valley.
My wife and I are planning to move to Asheville if we can. If we can manage.
That's so, a
yeah.
Those mountains are nice. It's part of the world.
It is. Although it's hard to beat this when you're sitting here on the
Luxury of this incredible Bayside Hotel. The magic of the Bayside Motel in beautiful Santa Harmonica.
Luxury, luxurious hardly defines it.
And this is what trauma takes you. You know, we don't need this. We don't bother with Shutters or the Lowe's. We stay at the Bayside where you actually get shampoo and liquid shower wash.
Wow.
Not just one bottle, you know, and it's not all in one. We get both, which is pretty good at the Bayside.
But not conditioner, too.
No conditioner. No,
you have to go up the street.
Got to go to Asheville for that.
Yeah.
Asheville.
Oh.
Grandfather Mountain. They got a lot of that there.
In Asheville, they got.
Well, it looks like the commissioner is moseying along. She judged 20 years as New York State Film Commissioner, and Pat Swinney Kaufman created the incentive, which all the other states have mimicked, to draw movies, you know, the tax and incentives to draw movies to the localities. New York State led the way. She wrote the incentive laws and got them passed, and New York has been booming ever since. She just retired.
I wish you could teach California a thing or two about that.
California blew it, yeah. They really made a mistake.
Big time.
Yeah, they sure did.
And you think of all the things, like Breaking Bad on AMC was supposed to take place here, and they couldn't afford to do it.
It's ridiculous. It's so stupid. Yeah,
just so
I agree.
Stupid.
Yeah. Well, New York was stupid for many years. Yeah. When I started out, New York was forcing the unions. They were forcing companies from out of town to have standby. If you were a director from California, came to New York, you'd bring your own DP because you'd want your own DP, director of photography, not double penetration, Frank.
Yeah.
Please.
Okay.
You
went
bring
the wrong
your own.
Way.
Yeah. And you had to have a standby guy who stood around just picking his nose and getting $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, $600,000, whatever they make on these things. And it was awful. So nobody was coming. There were no movies coming to New York.
You need a standby guy on the other kind of DP as well.
Though. Yeah, that is true. Yeah. That is true. The fluffer standby.
Yes.
Well, at any rate, back to Ramona. William Wellman, one of the greats, Although I always found him a bit ponderous, to be honest. I mean, his movies are terrific, but I'm more of the Sam Fuller, and I became friendly with Sam Fuller, and Troma's War is a bit, he loved Troma's War.
Did he?
Yeah, he saw that, he really loved it, and we bought Shark, you know, from, company, and Shark was a movie that had been taken away from him and got all chopped up. And we tried to find, he agreed that he would love to recut it back to what he intended it. This is with Burt Reynolds.
Yeah.
And we couldn't find any, all the footage has been dumped, I guess.
Wow.
Well, it was independent in Mexico or something.
But
Life Magazine had a feature in the shark in that movie actually ate the stuntman in real life. And Life Magazine showed the photos, That we were not part of the making of that film in any way.
Yes. You want to distance yourself from that.
Our crew would have eaten the sharks. Our crew was so hungry.
No.
Our food is so bad at Tromaville movies that they would eat the shark.
No one.
The shark would not eat the stuntman.
No one on a Troma film has ever been eaten by a shark.
No.
That's something you could be proud of.
No. We've had lots of spider stings on Return to Newcomb High. We had major invasions of spiders. Niagara Falls, New York, seems to be the spider capital of the world.
I almost did the Niagara Falls.
Oh, slowly I took. Yeah.
Let's turn to when you started getting into filmmaking. Was that just an offshoot? You were at Yale, and
my
opportunity started coming up.
My roommate Robert Edelstein was producing. Wanted to produce. We're both Hawthorne fans. Nathaniel Hawthorne. And he had the idea, let's make Rappaccini's Daughter. So, and he had a Bolex 16mm camera, but you cannot shoot sync sound with it. So I told him I'd produce it for him, and I knew nothing, of course. And we put it together. We put up, we casted, we got Perry King to play the main part. He went on to be a big star.
Sure.
And Rappaccini we shot in black and white, 16 millimeter reversal film. And it was basically a silent movie with narration, a few sound effects, and some music, kind of music like, oh gosh, having a brain fart, sorry. Anyway, it was kind of contemporary classical music. So it was not, and it was very slow and ponderous. If you know the story, it is a... a young woman lives in a poisonous garden owned by her scientist father, and the Perry King character stumbles in, but it's very slow and very moody and appealed to absolutely no one. But it was a very good experience just to see Robert at work and and learn kind of the basics of what had to be done to put all this stuff together.
Yeah.
And then I bought a Bolex and made The Girl Who Returned, a feature-length movie, which was a comedy. It was supposed to be a comedy. It was also unwatchable, but it it had enough entertainment value, so I was able to send it around to a lot of colleges and charge a dollar admission. And I learned that no matter how bad a movie is, the audience, for the most part, will not ask for their money back. I also had
good lesson to learn.
When it opened at Yale, The Girl Who Returned, it's one night, of course, we had posters of The Girl Who Returned was about two lands. The earth has got the men living in one country and the women in the other country. They come together and have Olympic games to determine the supremacy of the world every 4 years. And the movie was awful. But I had a poster of the track star, non-male, lying on her back, exhausted, and had on kind of a tight T-shirt, and she had some pretty good-sized love pillows under that T-shirt, and the poster looked pretty hot. And the same night, Frank Borzage's Moonrise was playing it.
Wow.
And they had a poster up that just said, Frank, you know, this is a masterpiece.
Sure.
This is a real masterpiece. It just said Frank Borzage's Moonrise. And I think three people showed up for Borzage's movie. But The Girl Who Returned had like 350 people. So I learned a little something about marketing.
Yes.
And in those days, by the way, the students were all doing kind of psychedelic short pieces and doing all kind of goofy, stupid, pretentious technique. It was all that kind of stuff. And I wanted, right from the start, wanted to do feature-length narrative. And that was a novelty. So The Girl Who Returned did go to quite a number of colleges.
This sounds like one of those old guys talking about, well, back in my day, but when I was in college in the 70s.
Oh, I thought you were talking about me, because I am one of those old guys talking about back in my day.
I'm trying not to sound like it, but I do. But it, in the days just prior to home video, it seemed like people were really much more open to other experiences in the movies, that you could... I remember being in Harvard Square, and there'd be The Grand Illusion or Seventh Seal, packed house. I mean, packed house in Harvard Square Theater.
And there were those theaters all over the country.
Yeah.
You had those revival houses everywhere.
Yeah, you would never pack a house with those films. Never.
Well, the other thing was, it was harder to see those movies. We would go through the New Yorker magazine every week when I was up at Yale, because the 42nd Street grindhouses would play double features. Every day they'd change it. 35 millimeter double features, and you know they'd have Cheyenne Autumn by John Ford with Sons of Katie Elder on a double, and then we, oh my gosh, look at that, it's Tay Garnett's Play Dirty. Oh, we got to go. So we jump on the train, we go to see the, and all these bums, and you know, the floors were disgusting, and these bums would be sleeping in the theater, and we'd be, oh wow, it's Tay Garnett's Play Dirty, we got to go see that. And but you know, that kind of spirit's gone. You know,
yeah.
you catch, you can get the DVDs or the YouTube or whatever. But those houses on 42nd Street, they all went, you know, they eventually,
sure,
I think went porno. But I remember a guy ran up the aisle with an fire axe and attacked another guy. I don't think he hit him with it, but I mean, it was quite interesting. And there was a show in the theater and on the theater and now today. I actually go to the theater with my movies very often, and the audience will show up. If you know, it has to be made into kind of a show.
Sure.
You know, it's very interesting. It's kind of as, I mean, we don't have people, bums running up the aisle with the fire axes, but
I'll be glad to do that if you'd like me to.
We may need it at the Cinematheque, the Cinematheque tonight.
Yeah, by the time this airs, of course, that will already have been
passed. Oh, yes, but, that will have been.
But they're doing a marathon of Troma films at the Aero Theater in Santa Monica,
to
right?
To honor Troma's 40th year of failed filmmaking, we're going to have a big Cinematheque marathon of Troma movies. And there'll be many Troma celebrities there, too.
Wow.
After this, I mean, again, this is all in the past that we are talking about.
Yes.
But since Citizen Toxie is a time travel movie, an alternate universe movie, it all works out.
Yeah. When you're listening to this 2 weeks from when we're talking, just will yourself back in time and you can go to the Arrow.
You bet.
Yep.
It's called the Tromarrow.
Now, I've really been struck by how varied your film experience was before Troma.
By the way,
you worked on Rocky, right?
If I may interrupt, sure. I remember making the decision to make movies.
Yeah.
It was during a showing at the Yale Film Society of Ernst Lubitsch's To Be or Not to Be, with Jack Benny, Carol Lombard, and Robert Stack. And I was so really knocked out by the fact it's a crazy, crazy movie, but yet it's totally disciplined and totally controlled. It was in the dark there, and I decided, I think there were two other people in the room with me, and I decided, right, it was as easy as getting out of the easy chair and going over to the refrigerator and cracking open a beer, you know, it just was, and I decided right there. So if you want to blame somebody for Troma and my 40 years of failed filmmaking, go to the graves of Ernst Lubitsch, Carol Lombard, Robert Stack, and Jack Benny and urinate on them. It's their fault.
Well,
I could have been a dentist. I could have been a very successful dentist, God damn it.
Yeah, but would it have been nearly as much fun?
Well, no.
You would have been a lot richer, that's for sure.
Definitely would have been more disgusting. Can you imagine looking into old women's mouths and smelling their breath? And, oh, my God.
Oh, I can imagine it.
That's why we in Citizen Talk, in many movies, we tend to we take it out on old, disgusting women. If you look at the Troma, it's one of the themes of Troma's.
One of the recurring themes.
Yes.
When we're talking about Lloyd Kaufman, the auteur.
Yes,
that's
indeed.
That's one of the themes.
The hostility toward old women.
Yes.
Well, Monsieur Verdoux, man.
Oh.
That's my anthem.
Oh, God.
That's such a wonderful film, and he's killing off all these miserable old women who are sitting on piles of money. He's got a beautiful family. The wife is a cripple, and you really wish, keep killing those old women. And then at the end, when Chaplin's hauled off to jail, and he says, as a criminal, I'm only an amateur, you know.
Yeah.
And he says it in the context of World War II having just happened, and segregation, and lynch. I mean, all the horrible, you know. I mean, oh boy, what a movie! That's and yet it was not successful. I understand when it came out, right?
No, his last few films did not.
It's unbelievable.
You know, we just saw Limelight at the Academy, maybe 6 months ago. Time means nothing to me, but. I'd never liked that film because it always seemed so empty for some reason. And every time he'd come out, there's just total silence and he would do his bits. And for the first time, I saw it with a huge audience and the bits were getting big laughs and they worked like a charm. The whole movie works beautifully. So everything I had always thought about it, seeing it by myself or even seeing it in sparsely populated theaters.
Right.
And I'd always walk out saying, oh, gee, that's not a very good picture.
The Circus is another one that'll do that to you, too. I've seen it with a small crowd. People are walking out. And then you see it with a giant crowd. And the people are weeping. You know, the music that Chaplin wrote for it and the whole thing. And they're laughing. I mean, it you know, same thing happens with my movie, Tales from the Crapper. I mean, the exact same thing, Frank. You know?
Yes.
You need a huge audience.
The
fullness of time is always on your side if you're making masterpieces. Luckily, the Tales from a Crapper will never have a huge audience, so you can never prove me wrong.
don't count yourself out. It'll get there.
No, but, I hope not, actually.
I love much about Troma. I've always liked Troma pictures. I saw Toxic Avenger when it was brand new. And one of the things I like about it is exactly this, which it tends to be an audience enterprise, that it's an event when these films are shown publicly, and especially when you show up and when other people connected show up. It gets all these people together in a big audience, an enthusiastic audience, and then you walk out thinking these movies are great. And I think that's almost the case with every film. Not that you're going to think every film is great, you're not, but seeing it with a big audience makes a difference, don't you think?
Well, certainly the great directors, without a doubt, and it just takes time for word of mouth to spread. But I doubt very much that 20 years from now you're going to want to see AI with a big audience. with all due respect to all involved.
I did see it with a big audience, and it didn't help.
So, I mean, I'm an auteur theorist to this day. I believe it's all about the director, you know. And you go to, you see Von Sternberg's movie, the one he did with the islands and the Asian. It's very rare.
Oh, toward the end.
What's the name of it? They're showing it in New York this week, and I'm missing it.
Shoot.
I saw it at the Cinémathèque Française when they had the trauma. They had the trauma event the same night. You know what I'm talking about.
I do, and yeah. I'm picturing.
But it's wonderful.
From it,
I mean, you just know that it's going to.
I hate when this happens.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in any event, what are you going to do? Well, I mean, Von Sternberg's another one that got a raw deal. You know, the epic that never was, I Claudius.
I Claudius
would have been his best movie, and he got stopped by people who just didn't wanted to interfere with a genius. You know, it's awful. You know, and Emlyn Williams and he's a great actor, but he's not his movie. He should shut up and let Von Sternberg do his work. They ruined him. You know, Van Damme ruined John Avildsen's, could have been a very good movie that Avildsen directed with Van Damme in it, and Van Damme took it away from him and edited it, and as a result, it flopped. I saw the dailies, and I know that could have been a really good John Avildsen, Capra-esque kind of character, you know, comedy, action, and Van Damme didn't get it, you know, and it's a crime. Well, of course, Robert Wise did a little damage to Orson Welles, if I don't forget, right?
Well, you remember I wrote a book about Wise.
I know, I remember that.
And knew him pretty well. And I talked with him quite a lot about that, because, you know, he was...
Well, he edited Citizen Kane, did he not?
He edited Citizen Kane. You've got to give him that.
Yeah, of course.
And then when Magnificent Ambersons comes along, in one way...
Sort of like House of Cards. What happens in House of Cards.
Yeah.
He gets rid of the guy.
Yeah.
He takes over, becomes president.
But I don't believe that Wise stabbed Wells in the back, because Wells was often in South America, and he was not paying attention to the studio.
I don't doubt it.
And the studio just went, then we'll do it ourselves. And so...
I met
Wise... Not to
Wise,
say that was right, but it was. But Orson brought it on himself.
I think there's a lot of truth to that, yeah. And I've met Wise a couple of times, and he sure seemed like a very nice, amusing, rather urbane gentleman. I agree with you.
I've often wondered what he was like as a director, because he seemed like such a great guy when I knew him after. But I interviewed George Chakiris on the podcast not long ago, and he said that Wise just didn't say much of anything to anybody.
nothing wrong with directing that way. It's probably better than teaching them how to do it when they already know how to do it.
I think a lot of directors are like that, right? What do you think? If you cast the right person, then the right person knows what to do to a certain extent.
I think if you discuss it and have plenty of preparation time, I think a lot of the problems today is everything's so expensive, there's no rehearsal. You know, Troma makes a movie, we have 3 months of rehearsals.
Wow.
And our movies are $500,000, and these $200 million movies have no rehearsal.
Yeah, they just don't have the money.
Yeah, they can't they can't afford the rehearsal time, which is stupid. And that's, I think, why a lot of them are so ephemeral, and they don't last. You know, you look at them today, and they're horrible.
Well, as a director yourself, because speaking of the auteur theory, I've been thinking about this a lot over the past couple of years, that when I was growing up, the auteur theory was pretty new when I was first studying film. And so I really bought into it big time. But I think for the longest time, I always thought that directing was actually, if I look back on it, was actually cinematography and editing, you know. And I would always think, oh, John Ford, what a beautiful eye for composition he has. Or Sam Peckinpah, who I, you know, Wild Bunch, I just revere that film. But you think, oh, he was a great editor. Well, he didn't edit the film. He directed the film, and it's a different thing. And so my thinking is coming around to a different way of looking at what directing is. So that's what I ask you. This is a simple question. What is directing to you? And do you agree? I mean, do you see what I'm saying?
I see what you're saying. I personally control everything. I don't physically do the editing, but I sure as hell am in control of it. And and we take we take a long time with the movies I write and direct are long term. They take years, even though they may look improvisational, and there is a lot of improvisation there. But we prepare and prepare and prepare, and we discuss and go. I take a lot of input from people, but when I'm on the set, that's it. You know, if I want it, then it's me. I get it. You know, it's my decision.
Yeah.
And same in the editing. And I've Citizen Toxie. There's a scene there where we had focus groups for Citizen Toxie, the Toxic Avenger Part 4, and there's one scene in particular that. The movie would come to a screeching halt with the audiences. They'd be laughing and laughing and having the best time, and this scene would come along, and they'd shut down. And the editor, my wife, I think James Gunn, everybody told me, cut that scene out. And I didn't, because I felt that has to stay. That's people have to remember that there was in Texas, they drag black people around by pickup trucks until their limbs fall off. I wanted that to be memorialized. And I know that it... to some extent may have affected the audiences to some, and maybe it wasn't commercially a smart move, but it's an art form. So I think I believe the director should have total control. I do a lot of my own camera work. I don't do it all, and in fact as I've gotten a little older and a little lazier, I do let the camera man do a lot more work, because I've got video feedback now. I can look at it on the video tap. We've never been able to afford the video tap.
Yeah.
So now that I can actually see what the shot is as it's happening in real time, I've relied more on the cameraman. But for handheld stuff, I always did my own handheld, because I was the only one who could look through the camera. We didn't have the video. Yeah. You know, we didn't have the play. We couldn't see it in real time. Couldn't afford it.
Yeah.
Return to Nuke 'Em High Volume 1 is the first movie I've made with a digital camera, the Arri Alexa. And we had I could look at the video monitor while the cameraman was dealing with the camera, and that was good stuff. That was a big advantage for me.
It seems a lot that shooting on digital has a lot of advantages of shooting on film, aside from the look and all that stuff, which are different. But
it has disadvantages too.
Yeah.
I mean, on my level, it's just as expensive. The camera, which was the most expensive camera I've ever had, and I only had one camera. Usually I have three cameras with the crappy 50-year-old Aeroflex PLs that I've used. I've been able to have three cameras, so if we're doing a stunt or a special effect, I can have three angles, and it'll cut.
Yeah.
With this movie, Return to Nuke 'Em High Volume 1 and 2, only one camera because it was so expensive. And I didn't have all the lenses I usually have. And then when you can say, well, how cool with video, with digital, you can shoot, you can do as many takes as you want. Yeah, but then you have to go back and download all that crap, and
sure.
it's extremely costly. It's man hours and logging, and there's a lot of downside to it. But I've converted to digital late in the game. But this Aeroflex Alexa has convinced me that's the way to go. I think it's better than 35mm now.
Do you rehearse so much because you want to keep the number of takes down to a minimum?
No, I rehearse a lot because it's comedy, and comedy is very much a work in progress.
Yeah.
We don't have the Chaplin, Keaton, those guys had vaudeville. They could hone their art and their scenes, and they could practice. We have no way to do that, so we only have rehearsals, and we rehearse in a rehearsal studio. Then we go on location and rehearse, and I film the movie twice. I go to the location and film everything that we rehearse on location, the whole movie basically, and then finally we film it. And it's this new film. It's about a 3-month pull. including the filming. The two months of preparation for the actors, and then we, and again, the actors I use are young and inexperienced, and they, you know, they need to get used to the camera and be able to relax and get into the acting part. And most of them are very talented, but they haven't done it before. They don't know about hitting marks and moving their head while they're trying to be emotional, so they don't put a shadow on the other person's face, and you know, all that kind of stuff. They don't, they don't know that, and they don't know to shut up. You know, when they have to shut up, and you get all that going, you can get all that stuff out during the long pre-production period. So as a director, I do control everything, and in the script takes at least a year to write. At least Romeo and Juliet was 5 years.
Wow.
But that's not to say Troma doesn't keep making movies. We have other directors who are much faster and probably more commercial.
How many movies do you have going at any given time?
Well, right now we're extremely poor. Business sucks, so we're with one or two a year, if we're lucky. If we're lucky. This time we have Return to Newcombe High Volume 1 has played about 100 theaters, mainly calendar houses. Museum of Modern Art started it off. And in fact, Museum of Modern Art put it in the Contenders series, which is they call the best movies from around the world, which is kind of frightening. But it was in Return to Newcombe High was in with Woody Allen's film and David Lynch and Sofia Coppola and Von Trier and Lloyd Kaufman. So and then it went to the New York and L.A. for a couple of weeks. But all the other theaters have been calendar houses, and that and while that's going on, we're making Volume 2 of Return of Newcombe High. Return to Newcombe High. We're shooting that. We're shooting Return to Newcombe High, and then Mutant Blast is being by another director who worked for us and is we think very talented. Is making a movie called Mutant Blast, which will be shot in Portugal. He is Portuguese, but he's worked on our movies, and he made a short film that was brilliant, very funny. We will shoot it where he wants to shoot it, and right after Cannes. I'll go over there, and they're in pre-production now. It's going to be in Portuguese too, which will, just in case it was commercial, we'll put it in a language that nobody speaks except countries that totally pirate your movies. Like Brazil.
You can always shoot in Aramaic.
Aramaic, it would be Troma-Aramaic.
It would be nice. When you're thinking about budgets, do you have a pretty solid idea of how your movies perform? I know it's always a crapshoot, but to what extent do you budget your films based on what you think the business is? I mean,
to no extent. We make no money whatsoever. That's very liberating. We're totally blacklisted. And I mean economically blacklisted, not for content, but because the industry has become totally consolidated since I started making movies. When we made Squeeze Play, there were 2,000 or 3,000 theaters around the country. Most of them were owned by family chains, and they were local, and they needed movies that were commercial or that people would show up for. The rules that used to prevent monopoly have been done away with. So the consent decree of 1948, which created all these individual chains, which stopped the major studios from owning movie theaters, that law went away. So now all the movie theaters are under the thumb or actually owned by the giant conglomerates. So we're totally frozen out, except for maybe if I direct a movie, I can maybe get into 300 calendar houses or a weekend here or a midnight there, you know, maybe 300 screens. The original Toxic Avenger was on 2,000 screens for many weeks. So it's the TV world has changed too. It's consolidated, and Rupert Murdoch can own TV stations and newspapers in the same market. The TV companies don't have to show independent movies. They used to be required to show independent content. The FCC had a financial syndication rule which required the networks to take a third of their programming from independent sources. That's gone away during Clinton's administration. So it is virtually impossible for Troma to make any money, even if we had Gone with the Wind. Cannibal the Musical by Trey Parker and Matt Stone, which is an amazing film, has never been on TV. The first, Citizen Toxie, the Toxic Avenger Part 4 has never been on, not even shitty Skinamax, nothing. And so we can't, so we know going in that we will lose pretty much, you know, maybe over time we break even and make a little money. But we know that, so it doesn't matter. You know, we can do whatever we want. It's pretty, it's very liberating. And the other nice thing is we don't have to get Return to Nukem High Volume 2 ready for Christmas time. That's Peter Jackson's job. He's got to get his, you know, he's got that pressure. We don't have that pressure because nobody wants our movies.
Yeah, so just whenever you finish it, it's fine.
When we feel it's right, and believe me, a lot of good creative cogitation comes during the post-production. I mean, you go to see Return to Nukem High Volume 1, which the New York Times gave quite a good review, as did other major media. You see that movie, a lot of the big laughs were put in during post-production. We're just, you know, when you have the back of somebody's head, you can have them say something funny. And there's all sorts of stuff that comes in during, if you have the time, if you're not rushed.
Yeah. Well, is it just because you have a large library that enough income comes in that, that allows you to make the next picture? I mean, the money has to come from somewhere.
We have about 800 movies. There's a little revenue coming in that comes in crumbs. And we have maybe 12 movies like The Toxic Avenger and Class of Nukem High and Romeo and Juliet. And they get constantly re-licensed for small amounts. And my books make a little dough. And we have some comic, the T-shirt business, you know.
Sure.
People licensed Toxie T-shirts and toys. And so it's but it's running on the memory of fumes, basically. we're fucked.
Yeah.
Michael Herz and I love movies, and that's really what keeps us going. And we have a small but very idealistic group of young people who love making movies they believe in, and somehow we stagger along. We have enough critics who like our movie, you know, at least let the word come out. The internet is a great way for us to interface with our fans, and somehow we keep going. And this is our 40th year.
Well, some years ago, you licensed, or did you buy the Rhone Group, or did you just...
We bought the Rhone Group.
So all of those were films from the 30s and 40s and 50s and around there, which couldn't have had that much of an audience, but I got the feeling that you did that because you liked the movies.
Well, some of them were lost movies also. Some of them were never going to get out. And we tried it. We lost money on every one. But they're beautiful. What's his name? Rhone. Now I can't remember his first name. He's from North Carolina. He had the best preprint materials. And those DVDs are beautiful. But again, we got absolutely no... encouragement from any of the media. You know, none of the New York Times or L.A. Times or any of the mainstream movie trade magazines. You know, we would go to all this. You did some introductions for us. And
I would have thought that would have put them right over the top.
If they don't recognize Frank Thompson, you know,
right.
So it got discouraging.
Hard to imagine.
I think we still put out one or two here and there, but we have no money. That's our problem, and we didn't even have money for the Toxic Avenger Blu-ray. Is something that you know all the fans want. They think for some reason we're not doing it, and the only reason we're not doing it is very expensive.
Yeah, well,
we have no money.
Yeah, to do the 4K scan that you
would
need to do Blu-ray.
That's right.
Is monstrous money.
And the labs have gone out of business. So now, when if we want to make a low contrast print or a release print, any kind of print, we have to get everything has to be retimed because it has to go to another lab. And there's only one lab really left in New York, and it's Technicolor.
Yeah.
I mean, there's one other, I think. But they charge you the same rates they charge the studios because they know they can.
Yeah.
There's nobody else there to do it.
Only game in town.
We're screwed.
Yeah, that's why.
Royally. Yeah,
it's just.
and the so-called independent movies that are out there that you see on your movie screen, they come in through the vassals of the big conglomerates, Fox Searchlight, Sony Classics. And I'm sure they're very good movies, but they're not the kind of movies that are going to change the world. They're movies that, the Tribeca is showing a Zombiever, right? We made Poultrygeist, Night of the Chicken Dead, 8 years ago, and they wouldn't even spit on it. Now they're showing this movie, Zombiever, about zombie beavers, the Tribeca Film Festival. You know, they're 10 years behind the times, and that's,
sure.
But that's the way they are, and I'm sure it's probably coming in through one of the vassals of one of the big time, majors.
Yeah.
So, even though it's not a major, it's a division of a major or a vassal of a major. So, and unfortunately, unless you're in with one of those majors, you die. And that's why there are so many talented directors. They make one movie and then maybe the next one doesn't do so well and the majors just throw them away like an old glove. It's a tough. We luckily, Troma's got a fan base and they support us and we stagger along. And in the fullness of time, there is some recognition. I mean, the art world is giving us a lot of attention now because of the Museum of Modern Art putting Return to Nukem High Volume 1 in the Contender series. And I think that may be why American Cinematheque and Philadelphia Museum of Contemporary Art is doing a Troma event, and the Warhol Museum has me in there quite a bit. But that doesn't make payroll.
Yeah.
It's tough.
Yeah, it's horrible. I mean,
look at the careers of Orson Welles. Look at how many great. Preston Sturges was ruined by the conglomerates. Well, I mean, they weren't conglomerates, but they had as much. They had more power than the conglomerates in those days.
Yeah. And he who made better movies than he did?
Yeah, I mean, geez, he couldn't make any better, and they just tore him down like Gulliver and the Lilliputians. They were the Lilliputians. They just tied him down and made him go nuts.
Yeah, it's a cliche, I guess, but Hollywood has never liked the Mavericks, and they never make room for them.
Well, also
like
they don't.
Always had problems.
They don't want they don't want to change the status quo. And the Troma movies are very. The stuff we do is people say is subversive. Really, it just reflects what's going on in society. It's not subversive. And in a fair world, Poultrygeist, Night of the Chicken Dead should have been a huge hit. There's no question about it. People love it. Unfortunately, very few people know about it.
Yeah, it must be frustrating because. Every time I've ever seen any of your films with an audience, it goes over really big.
Yeah.
People really love them, but there are many people that you mention them to because the titles sound jokey or whatever. They just don't consider going to see them. They just think,
Well, also, they don't know about them.
Yeah.
You know, they don't get the hype that, the Variety and Hollywood Reporter, we don't exist. No matter what happens, we don't exist. You know, New York Times, Troma's been making movies for 40 years in New York City, paying people who would be on welfare otherwise. We own a building there. We had our 30th year, nothing. Our 40th year, how many independent studios in New York City, period, and how many have been there for 40 years? Nothing.
Wow.
But meanwhile... 28 Days Later is the first zombie movie ever made, the way they wrote it up, because it's 20th Century Fox, and Harold and Kumar go to the White Castle Part 3. Oh, my God, A.O. Scott can't say enough about how the farts and the projectile vomiting are just such great American satire, and as if nobody's ever done it before. Troma pioneered the projectile vomiting, if you want to know.
Well, I think any history book will tell you so. Well... Here's what I'm wondering about. When you and Michael Hurt started Troma, Toxic Avenger was the first Troma film?
No.
Am I right?
No, we made movies before Troma, before Toxic Avenger.
Well, I know you made several movies before that, but I thought
Squeeze Play, Waitress,
Troma.
Battle of Love's Return.
Forget I said
in which Oliver Stone was in. That was the first movie I actually had in a real movie theater, and that got good reviews from the New York Times and Judith Crist and those guys. Squeeze Play, Waitress, Stuck on You, First Turn On. And then we reconstructed Bloodsucking Freaks, which had a false start. Someone had chopped it all up and put it out as an R-rated movie, and and we were able to buy it out from under them, and we put it back to the condition that Joel Reed, the director, wanted it, and it became kind of a classic. So we made several movies before The Toxic Avenger. They were raunchy comedies, and we made them before Porky's, so we got a little bit ahead of the game there. Then the studios started making the same raunchy movies, but we're using stars and then one day Variety, one of those rags, had a headline that said horror movies are dead, commercially.
Yeah.
And so Michael Herz and I said, okay, let's go there, and we like comedy, so we made a satire and slapstick satire horror film with lots of Chaplin, Preston Sturges, and Frankenstein. When Squeeze Play came out, it was both praised and it mixed sex and slapstick comedy and satire. But the theme was the women's liberation movement, it would play weeks and weeks and weeks, because there was nothing like it. It was ahead of this Porky's kind of stuff, and it had some interesting political content. And it had all, and yet San Francisco reviewer said that movie was made on a garbage scow. Janet Maslin in the New York Times loved it. They got it, but it did have the trauma. It had the humanity of trauma. It had the raunchiness. It had you would clearly recognize Stuck on You as a trauma movie, without a doubt. First Turn On, for sure. They just didn't have the graphic cartoon violence. They were raunchy comedies, but they were very trauma-esque. And they did very well in those days. The Squeeze Play, especially, nobody wanted to play that movie. Not one theater. And then American Multi Cinema in Norfolk, Virginia, put a print in for the weekend, a sneak preview,
mm-hmm.
and it went through the roof. The audience, they put it in with Peter Falk movie, the in-laws. They put it in with the in-laws.
Wow.
Squeeze Plays, like it was R-rated, but it was pretty close to X-rated, and the audiences loved it. And the next Monday, American Multi Cinema wanted prints for the whole country. We only had like two prints, so we ended up with over 100 prints of Squeeze Play. And Waitress, when Waitress opened in New York City, we had 96 theaters in the New York area at the same time. It was a different time, and those movies are very good. People don't know about them now, but in their day, they had much wider theatrical distribution than anything we have today.
Sure. Well, because theatrical distribution was all there was.
Today, even so, they were probably better known with just theatrical distribution than, say, Terra Firma is with all the media. And that's one of my most personal film. As I say, we are economically blacklisted. We're just ignored. The big conglomerates play ball with each other, and they have the vassals that will bring in the so-called new independent movies, and we're outside with our faces pressed up against the glass.
Like Stella Dallas.
Stella Dallas, that's right. We give the party and the birthday party, and there's one child who's there, and that's it.
Oh.
Our own child. Trey Parker and Matt Stone made Cannibal the Musical.
Yeah.
It's terrific, and it has, you can say, well, the trauma movies can't play on TV because there's too much nakedness and nudity or whatever. The Cannibal the Musical is hilarious and totally benign. It sold 500,000 DVDs and video cassettes, and it's never been, and they're household words. They did South Park and Book of Mormon.
Yeah.
Never been on any form of television. Citizen Toxie, the fourth Toxic Avenger, sold more DVDs and cassettes than Cannibal the Musical, and has never been on any form of American TV. That's economic blacklisting. It's ridiculous. It did better than the first Toxic Avenger. The Citizen Toxie, the fourth Toxic Avenger.
Yeah.
So it's economic blacklisting. The rules have allowed the majors to control it's a cartel, and they're allowed to do it, just like in Mexico, where they have a drug cartel. If you want to go sell drugs in Mexico, you could be trauma, and you might be able to sell a few here and there, but, unless you're with the big cartel, you're screwed.
Yeah.
And here's the same thing with movies. If you're not in with them, if you don't have the big brother helping out, you are nowhere. You don't exist. They don't kill you, but you don't exist. And the proof is, where are the other independent movie studios? Where are they? Yes, they come and they go. They come, they're always new ones, and then they peter out. And it's not because they don't make good movies, Frank. It's because they do make good movies. Many times. Not always, obviously. But they can't get to the public.
Yeah.
And they also don't know how to make, we can make them, we know how to make a movie for $500,000 that looks like 20 million. They don't know how to do that. So they have to, they get these crappy stars, many of them, and they spend $2 million, and they can't get it back. They can't live. And then many times, they make really good $2 million movies, and they can't get it back. And, how can they go on?
Well, we're also in a weird time where everybody expects to get everything for free. And I put out my documentary, and, you know, sent it off to a couple of film festivals. I couldn't afford to send it to that many because
yeah, that's the
it
other
costs
thing.
Money.
Yes.
And
that's why I sent it to the Troma Dance Film Festival, which is in our 15th year, no entry fee. You don't have to pay to. Troma Dance is in its 15th year. You don't have to pay to submit your movies. The movies are shown for free and no VIP policy. This year it's in New York, in Brooklyn. And it's going to be June 27 and June 28th. Troma Dance, 15th year of this. We started it in Sundance as a poke in the eye to Sundance because Sundance is so hypocritical. And we would do it during Sundance in the same village, Park City, Utah. And we did it there for 10 years, and we've moved it. We outgrew that little town. So submit it to Stroma Dance.
I'll
cost
do
you,
that.
Cost you nothing. And I bet our audience would like it. Too.
Nothing is my favorite price.
You know, by the way, I just because I was whining a lot, we have some great American directors in the mainstream right now. So I, you know, Russell and Anderson and Payne and, you know, I mean, we have great American directors who are doing great movies in the mainstream. I mean, Aronofsky's Nowhere, I just saw that. What a work of art that is. I mean, so, you know, I'm whining a lot, but there's some great stuff coming out of the mainstream. God damn it.
Well, I was saying about my doc that as I was trying to get it out there, people were always saying, well, put it on Vimeo or put it on this or that. And it's all venues in which people watch it for free, and I think, okay, then people have seen it, but it doesn't really do me any good unless it creates some sort of groundswell for me, which I can't imagine is going to happen. So that's just
that's
just the world we live in.
If you're in with the elite, if you're in with the cartel, Rupert Murdoch and company, you do well. If you're not, you're eating dog food. We are giving away, to thank our fans for 40 years, we're giving away 250 of our movies on YouTube, Troma Movie Channel, for free. And why would we want to give them to Netflix and get 10 cents? I mean, it's insulting. And and Netflix is now now conspiring with Comcast and making sweetheart deals. They're getting rid of net neutrality and closing the door behind them on innovation, in my opinion. So screw them. We're giving the movies away. Let them. Michael Hirst still can't believe we're doing it. He doesn't quite get it. But better, you know, why not? I mean, we're in a different position. Troma's a brand name. We've had these really loyal, young, and poor. Our fans are all underdogs,
sure,
just like the characters in our movies. They're poor and they're young, and so give them the movies. Let them have it. They've supported us for, you know, for them, $15 for a movie ticket is a shitload of money. I see it. I go to the theater.
Yeah.
I see them. They don't have money. And most young people these days, it's the first generation in history that's less healthy financially than the previous one. So give it away. You're in a different position because you've got one movie or two movies. You know, we're a brand, so we feel, hey, maybe give them away. And, you know, every time somebody looks at a Troma movie for free, that's one less one less movie that MGM is selling.
Well, sure.
You know, and also we really love our fans, and we feel we owe them. We owe them everything. There's no question. We owe them everything. We'd be nowhere without our fans. And they really do appreciate it. There's no question about it. They appreciate it very, very much that we are giving them. And we also have another channel, Make Your Own Damn Movie Channel, And we every Friday we put up a little video lesson or an interview with a famous director or an underground director or lessons on how we sever an arm or how we put on a little souvenir Eiffel Tower that can go in somebody's eye. And you know, they're all different lessons that
sure.
you can learn, how we raise money, and that's the Make Your Own Damn Movie channel, so that's all free.
Well, what do you think about this new crowdfunding thing that's going on? Is that something that you can take advantage of, or is it?
We did. We crowdfunded. Michael Herz refused. My partner refused to pay for a trained duck in Return to Nukem High, Volume 1 and Volume 2.
You can't make a movie without a trained duck.
Well, they're very expensive. They've got a huge bill. So we went to our fans, and we raised. Our fans gave us $10,000 to hire Kevin the Wonder Duck, and learned a lot about ducks. Let me
tell
you.
Well, that's money well spent, I think.
I think so too. Kevin's got top billing. He's the only trouble is when we would feed him, he'd create a foul movement. Yeah, and ducks come in three, by the way. You can't just have one duck. There's got to be three ducks. Meanwhile, our actors and our crew are all sleeping. You know, we're all sleeping on the floor and learning how to defecate in a paper bag and living in a. We were living in a funeral home in Niagara Falls, an empty funeral home. Had the ducks got a manager and a trainer, two friends to come with them to keep. Apparently, they go nuts if they don't have an entourage.
Sure.
You know, the food and overtime. Nobody on Troma gets overtime. The duck 8 hours, then double time, then golden time. So, $10,000 later, and the fans put that up.
Nope.
We also are in the process of shooting a documentary, we're pretty much have it shot. Occupy Can, a follow up to our documentary called All the Love You Can, which we made about 10 years ago. We thought it'd be interesting mm-hmm. go back to Can. We go every year, but bring cameras back and see if the Can Film Festival has changed its attitude toward independent movies. How corporate is it? Elitist is it? It was fairly elitist 10 years ago, which was very different from when you and I used to go in the 70s, or at least I was there in 71.
I was not.
Oh, you never went to Cannes?
No.
Oh, I went. I've been going. Troma goes every year, and the first year we went, I slept on the beach. No problem. There was a festival. People thought it was kind of cute that a filmmaker would be sleeping on the beach. And now they put you in jail. You know, now it's all corporate fascist. And again, they show good movies, and it's a very interesting portage of people at Cannes and all that, but it ain't what it was. But anyway, so we decided we want to make another documentary, Occupy Cannes, which is totally not going to make any money. We know that. So we asked our fans to contribute. We went on Indiegogo and had the fans contribute a little. They put up about half the money, $50,000.
Oh, that's great.
And but we can't, I think... Unless you're famous, I don't think you can really raise money on Kickstarter.
No.
And we're proof of it. We're underground.
Yeah.
We're underground. And if you're, Spike Lee, who has a $30 million mansion in New York, he raised $3 million from poor people, which is good for him. And but I think unless you have a subject that people are fascinated with, like the New Beverly Cinema here in Los Angeles, I believe they raised $80,000 to make a movie about that theater, the documentary.
Yeah.
You know, if there's a subject that is compelling. I was recently interviewed for a documentary about John G. Avildsen. I've known him for almost 50 years. And that money was raised on Kickstarter because John G. Avildsen is a subject that people are interested in.
Sure.
But if you're just, I want to do a zombie movie or I want to make a new movie, here's my script. I don't think you can do it.
No.
I don't think Kickstarter will do it for you.
I think it's all based on who you know.
Well, also, I think Kickstarter and Indiegogo are very powerful for inventions.
Yeah.
If you've got a better mousetrap, there are just hundreds of thousands of nerds looking through it, looking for interesting things like that to contribute, to be part of.
Yeah.
But I don't think the world of art is part of that unless it concerns a certain subject or a celebrity that, or, you know, in Troma's case, we can do a little bit, but I think that was, I think our fans have done enough. I don't think I want to bother them again. But you never know. Maybe for Toxic Avenger Part 5, if I don't have any money for it, maybe I'll ask the fans. Because my Twitter is constantly. I mean, every day. When are you doing 5? What's going on with Toxic? We want to. So maybe they'll help us out. You know, even if it's a few bucks, you never know. So maybe we'll go back to them, but I don't think so. And I know Michael Herz, it's really beneath his dignity to do it. I don't mind begging. I've blown people, you know. Michael Herz still has, Michael Herz, my partner, has dignity.
Well, somebody has to, I guess.
Exactly.
But, yeah, I've thought about doing it for another project, but then I think, I already asked people for money for one project, and I feel, you know, there probably weren't five people I didn't personally know who gave me money. So
that's right. Yeah,
I just feel sheepish about it.
I think so. We did raise about 5 years ago. We had a huge deficit, and we raised. I think we owed some $5,000 for Troma Dance, and the fans paid for it. They put up the money.
That's great.
So that was nice. They came to our rescue because otherwise we couldn't have had. This was about 5 years ago. We would not have had a Troma Dance. We just didn't have any cash.
Well, I know that that the career has been a struggle in many ways, but I never can look at you without thinking, I'd like to be you. I don't care what the struggles are. I know that you have a great time doing this stuff, and it's not easy, but...
Well, again, Troma has been my life. It's been my entire career. And Michael Herz and I get along. It's a miracle that he hasn't killed me. And we love movies. I mean, we're fueled by a real love of the art. And that's it. I mean, it never was about money. We have made some money in the past. It's been a long time. But we've left our mark. And, the only regrets I have, Frank, are the few times where I've compromised the art. That's the only regret, and that's been a while since we've had to compromise.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think you've got a lot to be proud of. That's a great legacy of work.
Well, hey, I'm on the Frank Thompson podcast.
Come on.
That's
the pinnacle.
You said it. No question. It's the pinnacle and the pineapple and...
It is indeed.
It's everything.
It's a pinnacle upside-down cake.
Thank you.
Well, I appreciate it very much, Lloyd. I've been trying to get you on this show for... 2 years now, so we finally did it.
Well, let's do it again, Frank. Okay. And remember, the minute, as the Troma employees say, that the minute I get hit by a bus, suddenly the industry and the media will all say, "Oh, you know that Lloyd Kaufman? He really was movies of the future. He did so much for the art of film." And when the bus hits me,
I think that's something you'll
be vindicated.
Yeah, I will be. And when I get hit by the bus, people will say, "What? He did stuff?"
No way, not at all, not at all. I really enjoy talking with you about. We didn't talk enough about the filmmakers. You know, I have nothing better than talking about Joseph H. Lewis and Sam Fuller and Renoir and Kubrick and all of
We'll get all that done next time.
Next time. We should do one where we don't talk about it. Where Lloyd Kaufman doesn't talk about Lloyd Kaufman. We should do one where we all talk about certain directors or something.
Okay.
We should pick an era maybe and or maybe even do it on a director and just talk about one or two directors.
The next time you're
so
this
interesting.
Luxurious
hotel. I mean, King Vidor's book, A Tree is a Tree or whatever it is. He was fascinating. It's incredible how interesting these people were and what lives they had, too, and what they had to struggle through with the studio system.
I'll tell you a story. I was once at a dinner, and I was seated between Kevin Brownlow and King Vidor. And Jane Withers gets up and says that she wants to ask the blessing before we eat, and would we all join hands? So I contend that I'm the only human in history who's ever held hands with King Vidor and Kevin Brown at the same time.
Well, that's great.
While Jane Withers prayed.
Wow. And I bet you got a huge erection.
Well, I did.
I bet you did.
Have it to this day.
Well, that's pretty cool. That is very, very cool. All righty, Frank.
Okay,
well, thank
I'll
you,
let
you very
go.
Much. Thank you very much, and good luck to you. And thank you to all our fans who have supported Troma for all these years. We are sincerely grateful grateful to you.
If half the Troma fans listen to this podcast, I'm going to be on the map.
Yeah, you know, some of them, our fans are pretty interesting. They're poor, but you don't get too many. I don't run into too many Ivy League, but they know what's going on. They are very wise, and they're very well informed. I mean, it's really very interesting.
And they know a good movie when they see one.
They do indeed. They do indeed. And you'd be surprised how many of them do look at the classics and do admire the likes of King Vidor. They may not know Joseph H. Lewis, But they're pretty. Yeah. They do.
Just show them Gun Crazy, and then they'll
exactly.
watch everything
That's
else.
Right. Well, the problem with that is they'll go look at the one that the chick made.
Yeah. We don't speak of that one. Well, thanks, Lloyd. This has been great. As always, I had a wonderful time talking with Lloyd Kaufman. I really hope you enjoyed listening to it. I'm going to have him back because we have much, much more to talk about. He is really one of the most knowledgeable film people I've ever met. He really knows his film history. He knows his foreign films. He knows more about filmmaking than almost anybody I've ever met. I encourage you, if you're not familiar with the Troma brand, to watch some of those films because I believe that the nature of them, because they have kind of outrageous titles and posters and they sound more spoofy than they really are. Now, certainly they're filled with just horrible and mostly cartoonish violence and lots of nudity and lots of incredibly rude gags, but there's also a real serious heart that beats within each one of those. What that comes out to me, is that Lloyd Kaufman and Michael Hertz, his partner, have created a film company that is not like anybody else's and produce films that cannot be mistaken for the films of anybody else. And that's really something in my book. They're really in the avant-garde of what film is today. I hope that it does not take getting hit by that truck for people to start realizing what a great innovator and great filmmaker Lloyd Kaufman is, because he's one of the best there is. Now, I want to remind you, I've mentioned it in a couple of past episodes, but it's coming up this week, my first spin-off of the Commentary Track, which is a podcast called Radio Movies. I think the official title is The Commentary Track Presents Radio Movies. The concept is this. There are so many great radio shows of the 30s and 40s that were based on movies. And I love listening to them, and my wife Claire loves listening to them. As a matter of fact, Claire is more of a classic old-time radio buff than even I am. She listens all the time. She has something like 300 episodes of The Adventures of Superman on her iPod right now. And she's going through them, really moving through them, too. But I love listening to these. Sometimes they have the same cast as the films, and sometimes they don't. It occurred to me that it would be another way to approach talking about film history on a podcast, which is we would play the radio show, but I would introduce it by giving you some background material on the film and where it was produced and how and interesting stories about it. And then we can talk a little bit about how the cast changed or didn't change for the radio. And if there are major plot changes, it might be worth mentioning that too. I won't do that too much. That comes real close to spoilings. It's a great way to talk about film history and to talk about a way that films were marketed in those days. There are examples of films such as The Uninvited, which I will certainly play, that I found at least three or four different versions over the years, all with Ray Milland, who was in the film, but the supporting cast keeps changing from radio show to radio show. So there's interesting stuff like that, and I'm really tickled about this and having a great deal of fun putting it together and researching each film. The first episode, which will air this coming Thursday, May 1st, 2014, is Under Two Flags. This came about it was kind of random in a way because I just wanted a good one to start off with. And this one is introduced by Cecil B. DeMille. It has a cast that is completely different from the film. Herbert Marshall instead of Ronald Colman. Lupe Velez instead of Claudette Colbert. So it's quite a switch. But it's a terrific version, and it also has a couple of interesting special guests, which you'll have to listen to the episode to find out. We'll drop them every Thursday from here till the end of time. Now there are two podcasts that I hope that you will listen to, and I hope that you will tell your friends about that one. Even maybe people who don't want to listen to an hour-long conversation with somebody wouldn't mind listening to an hour-long, exciting, funny radio show. And I think they would be very, very happy if they did and discovered this new form. So that's coming up, and my wonderful announcer, Claire McCullough, also my wife, will also be my announcer on Radio Movies. I want to thank her for being a dual announcer. I want to thank James Hutchins for designing my websites, thecommentarytrack.com and frankthompson.tv. I hope you go to either one of those and click through to the Amazon banner and order any of my books or any of the books of my guests or videos of my guests. For instance, today I will post lots of Lloyd Kaufman's videos as well as the several books that he's written. And I hope that you will buy them all through my site, because when you do, I'll get a little bit of a kickback, and that ain't a bad thing. Thanks, of course, to the wonderful Rob Clearfield and the spectacularly legendary Gary Rand for writing my theme music fore and aft. And I want to thank you for passing the word along to your friends and for just listening to begin with. That's all I ask of you. Just listen to the podcast and enjoy it. All that other stuff is extra. I hope you'll do it, but I don't require it. Just that you listen and enjoy, and then every once in a while let me know what you think about it. That's very nice to me, and I appreciate it. So we've got another great one coming up next week, and Radio Movies coming up on Thursday. So in the meantime, don't you worry. We'll fix it in post.